AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
You know the name, you've definitely seen the blockbusters, maybe you even remember that whole heartthrob era, right? From the late 90s.
Yeah, absolutely. Defined it for a while there, big time.
But what if we told you there's actually a much deeper, way more complex story behind the Leonardo DiCaprio you think you know?
Mm-hmm. Because beyond the, you know, the red carpets and those really iconic roles, there's this whole fascinating journey there.
Right, of a fiercely dedicated artist, this unwavering environmental advocate, and, well, a man whose life choices have consistently sort of challenged public perception, forced us to rethink things.
Indeed. So today, we're not just touching on the surface, we're diving headfirst into the extensive life and career of Leonardo DiCaprio.
Yeah.
And this isn't just about his filmography, as impressive and frankly selective as it is.
Right.
It's about understanding the formative experiences, those incredibly intentional career choices, and the, well, the passionate commitments that have truly shaped one of the most influential and sometimes kind of enigmatic figures of our time.
We're hoping to connect some dots today.
Exactly. In a way that might surprise you.
So our deep dive today draws from a pretty rich stack of sources. We've got biographical excerpts that shed some critical light on his early days, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Detailed accounts of his many film projects, a thorough exploration of his really extensive philanthropic endeavors, and some fascinating insights into both his public and his private life.
Yeah, it's quite a treasure trove of material, actually. It offers a rare, comprehensive look at the man behind the, well, the global phenomenon. Yeah. Allows us to go beyond the tabloids and the red carpet soundbites, you know.
Totally. Get past the noise.
And our mission for you, the curious learner listening in, is to distill the most compelling insights, those genuinely surprising facts, and the key developments from all this information.
We want to give you a true shortcut, right, to being well-informed about DiCaprio's multifaceted impact.
Exactly. Offering those genuine aha
Yeah.
moments and maybe a fresh perspective, all without hopefully overwhelming you with information overload.
Think of it like connecting the pieces of a puzzle.
Yeah, to reveal a much clearer, more complete picture. So let's begin to unpack this remarkable journey.
Absolutely. And to truly understand the man, we have to start, well, at the very beginning, with the foundational elements of his life.
Makes sense.
So Leonardo Wilhelm DiCaprio was born on November 11th, 1974, right in the heart of Los Angeles, California.
Okay.
And the story behind his name isn't just a fun fact. It's quite poetic, almost prophetic, really.
Oh, yeah. How so?
Well, his pregnant mother, Ermilyn, felt him kick for the very first time while she was standing in the Uffizi Museum in Florence, Italy.
No kidding.
Yeah, gazing upon a painting by none other than Leonardo da Vinci.
Wow. That's actually incredible.
It's a moment that, you know, in retrospect, seems to kind of ripple through his entire life.
What's truly striking there is how that initial spark of art and, like, global connection quite literally seemed to foreshadow his future impact.
Yeah.
As an artist and an international figure.
Named after a Renaissance master.
Exactly. And his career would similarly become defined by artistic depth and this global reach. But beyond the name, his upbringing was, by all accounts, highly unconventional.
Right. Tell us about that.
His parents were Ermilyn Indenburken, who was a German legal secretary, and George DiCaprio, an underground comics artist and distributor. George himself was of Italian and German descent.
It's a real mix.
Oh, yeah. Quite diverse heritage. His paternal grandparents, Salvatore DiCaprio and Rosina Casella, were Italian. His paternal grandmother, Olga Ann Jacobs, was German.
Okay.
Then on his mother's side, his maternal grandfather, Wilhelm Indenburken, was German, and his maternal grandmother, Helene Indenburken, was a Russian immigrant living in Germany.
Ah, okay.
And it's important to clarify here, because you see this sometimes despite some persistent false claims, there's really no factual basis for a Ukrainian birth or heritage for his maternal grandmother. The sources consistently place her as a Russian immigrant in Germany.
That's a crucial detail to set straight, yeah. Misinformation spreads so easily, but wow, what an incredibly rich and diverse background.
It absolutely is. And it shaped his earliest years in, well, profound ways. When DiCaprio was just 1 year old, his parents divorced.
Okay, pretty young.
Yeah, but here's where their unconventional approach really shines. They made this unique and really intentional choice to remain deeply involved in his upbringing.
How did they manage that?
Well, they moved into twin cottages with a shared garden in Echo Park, Los Angeles, specifically so they could raise him together.
Twin cottages? That's unusual.
Right. George lived in one cottage with his girlfriend and her son, Adam Farrar. And DiCaprio developed a very close bond with Adam, effectively growing up with a stepbrother. So this raises a fascinating question for us, doesn't it? How might such a blended, kind of unconventional family structure, where parents remained closely co-parenting despite divorcing, influence a child's worldview?
You'd think it fosters independence, maybe.
Likely. An appreciation for diverse relationships, perhaps a certain resilience too, which probably served him well later in Hollywood.
That makes sense. And it definitely resonates with how he often speaks about his family. DiCaprio himself described his parents as bohemian in every sense of the word.
Right.
And quite tellingly, the people I trust the most in the world, which gives you such a strong glimpse into his core values, his influences.
Deep trust there.
But it wasn't just bohemian and artistic. He also frequently mentioned growing up poor in a neighborhood apparently plagued with prostitution, crime, and violence.
A tough environment.
Yeah. Yet amidst all this, he was raised Catholic. So you have this really interesting blend. Unconventional, artistic parenting, humble beginnings, direct exposure to some pretty intense societal challenges, all while holding on to a spiritual upbringing. How does this kind of environment, this sort of rich tapestry of contrasting experiences, shape a young, impressionable mind?
It must have instilled a keen sense of observation, I imagine. A desire to understand complex human behavior.
Maybe seeking out beauty or meaning in difficult circumstances, too.
Precisely. And in his childhood, this blend seemed to give him two distinct paths he seriously considered for himself.
Oh, what were they?
He either wanted to be a marine biologist.
Interested.
Or an actor. Ultimately, acting one out. And he explained why. He loved impersonating characters, he loved imitating people, and he especially enjoyed seeing their reactions to his performances.
The performer instinct was there early.
Incredibly early. Imagine this.
Yeah.
At just 2 years old, he apparently spontaneously danced on stage at some festival and got a really positive crowd response.
Wow, age two.
It's an almost primal, natural, theatrical moment, right?
Yeah.
Suggests an innate connection to an audience. But there was also a more practical financial motivation that kind of solidified his interest.
Ah, the practical side.
Yeah, his stepbrother, Adam Farrar, earned a substantial $50,000 from a television commercial.
Whoa, 50 grand back then for a kid.
Exactly. For a child growing up in their circumstances, that would have been a significant sum and a clear sign that, hey, performing could offer a real path.
You can absolutely imagine how that kind of money would look to a kid in that environment, a total game changer.
Exactly. And while there was an early brief venture into the children's series Romper Room, though his claim of being dismissed for being disruptive has been disputed by the show's host, interestingly enough.
Okay.
What's truly surprising is an almost entirely different career path he nearly took.
Really? What was that?
At age 11, he nearly quit acting altogether to pursue breakdancing.
Breakdancing? Seriously?
Yeah. Even placed second in a competition in his mother's native Germany.
No way.
Yeah. If we connect this to the bigger picture of his career, it shows an early inclination towards not just performance, but a willingness to explore different physically expressive avenues. It wasn't just about dialogue. It was about connecting through movement, character, sort of an athletic dedication.
That's fascinating. So when did the acting stick?
Well, his actual first role came at 14 in Matchbox car commercial.
Ah, the classic start.
Followed by spots for Kraft Singles, Bubble Yum, and Apple Jacks. True commercial kid, you know, learning the ropes one quick cut at a time.
You can almost picture him in those ads now, even knowing his later dramatic work. But his journey to the kind of stardom we know today wasn't exactly, well, an overnight success. Which is hard to imagine now, given his status.
Not at all smooth sailing, no.
The sources tell us he faced significant challenges right at the start, really struggled intensely to find an agent who believed in him.
Yeah.
And here's a truly surprising detail that speaks volumes about the industry back then. An early agent even suggested he change his name to Lenny Williams to appeal more to American audiences.
Lenny Williams, wow.
Can you imagine? He, thankfully, declined. A decision that feels almost like an early stand for authenticity, you know?
Absolutely. Good for him.
Despite attending around 100 auditions, he remained jobless for a grueling year and a half, seriously contemplating giving up acting entirely.
Year and a half. That's tough.
It's difficult to fathom that now, isn't it? His father, though, played a crucial role at this really disheartening point. Persuaded him to persevere, motivated him with the prospect of financial security, reminded him of his talent.
Thank goodness for his dad, then.
Right. And eventually, after a talent agent who knew his mother's friend recommended him, he finally secured roles in about 20 commercials, which was a huge stepping stone and really a testament to his sheer persistence.
Yeah, those commercials, while maybe small, they provided a much-needed foundation, honed his presence in front of the camera.
Built some momentum.
Exactly. By the early 1990s, DiCaprio began acting regularly on television, quickly moving into more substantive roles.
What kind of shows?
His early credits included a guest spot in The New Lassie in 89, a pilot for The Outsiders in 1990, and a pretty significant role as a teenage alcoholic in Santa Barbara, also in 1990.
Tackling heavy stuff early.
Yeah. And that role earned him a Best Young Actor nomination at the Youth and Film Awards, already showcasing his ability to handle darker material. Then his role as Gary Buckman, a troubled teenager in Parenthood from 1990 to 1991, shows an early commitment to character depth that would really become his hallmark.
How so?
Well, he specifically analyzed Joaquin Phoenix's performance in the original film to prepare. That's a remarkable act for such a young actor, right? Really digging in.
That's incredibly impressive for someone so young. It shows a dedication that was already, like, far beyond his years.
It absolutely does. And for a lighter, more fun anecdote, contrasting with his later dramatic roles, he was also a contestant on the children's game show Funhouse.
Get out, Funhouse!
Yeah, where he performed stunts like catching fish with his teeth.
No, I cannot picture the future Oscar winner doing that.
That's almost impossible, right? He also had a recurring role in Growing Pains in 1991 as Luce Brower, a homeless boy taken in by the Seaver family.
Oh, I remember that.
Producers had hoped to boost ratings with his appeal to young female audiences, a clear sign his charisma was already recognized, but it didn't quite work out long term for the show. His co-star, Joanna Kearns, described him as especially intelligent and disarming for his age, but also mischievous and jocular on set, hinting at that blend of intensity and playful spirit.
Sounds about right.
He also had an uncredited role in Roseanne in 1991. So he was truly learning the ropes, experimenting, absorbing everything across various TV formats, a real apprenticeship that built a crucial foundation for what came next.
That's quite the early resume, a true grinder for a while. And then came his feature film debut, a role he'd probably rather forget, but which, in hindsight, serves as a fantastic point of contrast.
Uh-oh, which one was this?
Critters 3 in 1991.
Oh boy, Critters 3.
Yep, he described it as a low-budget horror sequel playing your average, no-depth, standard kid with blonde hair. He openly called it possibly one of the worst films of all time.
Huh. Doesn't mince words.
No, a part he wanted to avoid in the future. What's fascinating here is his early self-awareness and a clear, almost immediate desire for more meaningful, character-driven work, even at that tender age.
It seems like that experience solidified his resolve, maybe, to seek out projects with more substance.
Exactly. He also had a brief, early role in the first Poison Ivy film in 1992. But then, almost dramatically, the trajectory shifted. Here's where it gets really interesting.
Okay, I'm right.
In 1993, he starred in This Boy's Life. And the story of his casting is pretty legendary.
No one.
He was handpicked by none other than Robert De Niro himself.
Wow, De Niro.
Yep. From 400 young actors to co-star in this adaptation of Tobias Wolff's searing memoir.
That's huge.
Director Michael Caton-Jones reportedly had to use a strict mentoring style for his behavior on set, indicating a young, perhaps spirited talent, but critics universally praised his portrayal. Complex growth from rebellious teen to independent young man.
You could see the talent was raw, but powerful.
Totally. It was his first film to gain significant critical recognition, and you could truly see that raw, untamed ability beginning to emerge on screen.
Absolutely. And then, the same year, came a role that just cemented his arrival. What's Eating Gilbert Grape?
Arnie Grape. Unforgettable.
This deeply moving portrayal of Arnie, the developmentally disabled brother of Johnny Depp's character, earned him his very first Academy Award nomination.
Incredible.
It's a testament to the quick recognition of his profound abilities. Interestingly, Caton-Jones, recognizing the young actor's unique gifts, recommended him to director Lasse Hallström.
Okay.
Hallström initially found DiCaprio too good-looking for the part.
Really? Too good-looking?
Yeah. Feared it would detract from the character's vulnerability. But after an audition where DiCaprio proved to be the most observant, embodying the character with startling authenticity, Hallstrom cast him.
And the rest is history, as they say.
Pretty much.
That detail about being too good looking is quite telling, though, given how he later fought against that heartthrob image, right?
It truly is. And this role genuinely showcased his dedication to character, even at such a young age.
How did he prepare for Arnie?
To ensure authenticity, DiCaprio actively studied similarly impaired children and their mannerisms. He essentially created the character from his own meticulous research. This wasn't just acting. It was this deep dive into empathy and understanding, a method Hallstrom fully supported.
Wow. At 19.
Exactly. At just 19, he earned a National Board of Review Award, a Golden Globe nomination, and his first Academy Award nomination for Best Supporting Actor, making him the 7th youngest Oscar nominee in that category ever.
That's amazing.
The New York Times critic Janet Maslin praised his sharp, desperate intensity, highlighting how at first he was actually difficult to watch because his portrayal was so vivid and unflinching.
Powerful stuff.
And Karen James, also at the Times, noted how he made the raw emotional neediness of those boys completely natural and powerful in both this boy's life and Gilbert Grape.
So that early, almost obsessive commitment to deep character work and authentic portrayal absolutely laid the groundwork for his later transformative roles.
No question. He was present right from the very beginning, a foundational aspect of his artistic identity.
Absolutely. It really set a precedent for his entire career, defining his approach. So after Gilbert Grape and that Oscar buzz, he intentionally took on diverse roles, clearly experimenting, trying to avoid being typecast.
Smart move.
In 1995, he appeared in Sam Raimi's Western, The Quick and the Dead. Interestingly, co-star Sharon Stone reportedly paid his salary because the studio had doubts about casting him.
Wow, Sharon Stone paid his salary. That's a huge vote of confidence.
Right. The film received mixed reviews, performed poorly at the box office, a minor setback, but clearly not a career ender.
Nope.
He then starred as a drug-addicted high school basketball player in The Basketball Diaries the same year. Another intense, challenging role showing his range.
Definitely not shying away from tough parts.
And Total Eclipse in 1995 saw him play the volatile poet Arthur Rimbaugh, a role he chose specifically to showcase his acting talent over his physical appeal.
Pushing back against the looks thing again.
Exactly. While that film failed commercially upon release, it's now considered a cult classic by Warner Archive, a testament to his early, bold, and often prescient choices.
Romeo plus Juliet in 1996 was unquestionably a pivotal moment. Launched him into a whole new stratosphere of fame, made him a global heartthrob.
That movie was everywhere.
Totally. Baz Luhrmann's abridged modernization of Shakespeare, remarkably retaining the original dialogue, but in this vibrant contemporary setting, initially made DiCaprio hesitant, maybe wary of the intensity of a classic romantic lead.
Understandable.
However, at his father's suggestion, he explored Luhrmann's earlier work, which led to a 2-week workshop and ultimately this hugely successful collaboration. Redefined the classic tale for a new generation.
He really did.
The film established him as a leading Hollywood actor, becoming profitable just days after release due to his surging popularity and the film's innovative appeal. David Thompson of The Guardian called him a vital spark in the film, utterly captivating.
You won awards for it too, right?
Yep. Earned a Silver Bear for Best Actor at the 1997 Berlin International Film Festival, international recognition of his growing talent. And he also held his own against acting heavyweights like Meryl Streep and Diane Keaton in Marvin's Room in 96.
Streep and Keaton, wow.
Yeah, Lisa Schwartzbaum praised the deeply gifted DiCaprio for his ability to stand out and ground the film alongside such veterans.
And then came the absolute tsunami, global stardom like we'd rarely seen before, 1997. He famously turned down a role in Boogie Nights, another huge film that would become a classic.
Right, P.T. Anderson.
To star opposite Kate Winslet in James Cameron's Titanic.
The big one.
He initially had some doubts about the role of Jack Dawson, maybe felt it was too conventional, but Cameron encouraged him, saw something special in their potential chemistry.
And he wasn't wrong there.
Definitely not. The film was, at the time, the most expensive in history. Budget over $200 million, famously including that full-scale replica ship.
Insane production.
It went on to become the highest-grossing film globally, earning over $2.1 billion after its 3D re-release.
Just staggering numbers.
The role transformed him into an unprecedented superstar, created what was universally known as Leomania among teenage girls and young women everywhere, made him a household name overnight.
Oh, I remember Leomania. It was intense.
But here's an interesting twist. Despite the film winning a staggering 11 Academy Awards,
11.
DiCaprio himself wasn't nominated for Best Actor, sparking protests from over 200 outraged fans against the Academy.
Fans protested the Oscars.
Wow.
It was a phenomenon unlike anything seen before, showed the immense emotional investment audiences had in him.
It truly was a unique moment in film history, and one that DiCaprio openly expressed considerable discomfort with, actually.
Really? Discomfort with that level of fame?
Yeah. Following Titanic, he stated in 2000, I have no connection with me during that whole Titanic phenomenon. I'll never reach that state of popularity again, and I don't expect to. It's not something I'm going to try to achieve either.
Wow, that's a strong statement, a conscious pivot.
Totally. He actively sought to shed his image as a teen idol and romantic lead, reduced his workload to learn to hear his own voice and choosing the roles he wanted.
So it wasn't a retreat, more like a strategic redefinition.
Exactly. Speaks volumes about his artistic priorities over just commercial appeal or maintaining that level of fame. Vox contributor Alyssa Wilkinson noted his boyish charm and natural and unaffected performance in Titanic, even years later, suggesting his innate appeal was still potent despite his efforts to move past it.
Right.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, his conscious decision to step back and redefine his career after such immense global success, rather than just catalyzing on it, it demonstrates profound artistic integrity and foresight, especially for someone so young.
He wasn't chasing fame, he was chasing the craft. That's an incredible level of self-awareness and artistic fortitude, especially for someone thrust into that kind of intense global spotlight. It perfectly explains why his post-Titanic choices certainly reflected that desire for diversification and a more serious artistic path.
What came next?
He took a brief featured role in Woody Allen's Celebrity in 1998, a performance praised by Bilge Ibiri as the best thing in the film, suggesting he could make an impact even in smaller parts.
Okay.
Then he tackled the dual roles of the villainous king Louis XIV and his secret twin brother in The Man in the Iron Mask in 1998.
Ambitious role.
Yeah, while critics like Owen Gleiberman praised his fluid and instinctive acting, many felt he looked too young for the gravity of the part, which might have hindered the film's reception.
Yeah, sometimes casting age is tricky.
He even won a Golden Raspberry for Worst Screen Couple, a stark contrast to his Titanic success. It certainly wasn't the kind of post-blockbuster trajectory many would have predicted.
Definitely charting his own course. And there was a notable what-if from this period too, right? One that really makes you pause.
Oh, yeah.
He turned down the role of Anakin Skywalker in Star Wars, Episode 2, Attack of the Clones, 2002.
No, Anakin Skywalker.
Yep. He stated he felt unprepared to take that dive into such a massive, established franchise at the time.
Wow. How profoundly different might his career have been? And the Star Wars saga, too.
Exactly. It speaks to his selectivity, maybe a reluctance to be swallowed by a pre-existing cinematic universe.
Oh, that's a mind-bending thought. Talk about a monumental fork in the road for both him and cinematic history. He also left the project American Psycho in 2000 due to creative disagreements.
Another interesting choice.
Opting instead for The Beach. While The Beach was commercially successful, grossing almost 3 times its budget.
Okay, so money-wise, it did well.
It was negatively reviewed by critics and, again, earned him a Golden Raspberry nomination for Worst Actor, highlighting the risks of his post-Titanic experimentation.
Right, critical reception wasn't great.
And beyond the reviews, the film also faced significant criticism for damaging its Thai filming location, which crucially prompted DiCaprio to actively work towards restoring the area.
Ah, so that environmental awareness was kicking in early.
Yeah. Exemplifies his willingness to take risks, even if they don't always pay off critically, and more importantly, his early genuine engagement with environmental impact, recognizing the responsibility that comes with his platform.
Good point. And wasn't there another odd film from around then?
Oh yeah, Don's Plum. Mostly improvised short film from the mid-90s. He and Tobey Maguire successfully blocked its U.S. and Canadian release after the director expanded it into a feature, arguing it was never intended as such.
Fighting for creative control again.
Exactly. It premiered at the 2001 Berlin Film Festival, but remains largely obscure. Again, demonstrating his fierce desire for control over his work.
This period also marks the beginning of several really high-stakes collaborations.
Yeah.
Ones that would not only define his career, but also solidify his reputation as a serious, versatile actor.
Okay, like what?
His first film in 2002, Catch Me If You Can, directed by none other than Steven Spielberg.
Spielberg, wow.
Yeah, a biopic about the notorious con artist, Frank Abagnale Jr. It was a critical and commercial triumph, grossed $355 million worldwide. A clear signal he could carry a major film without the Titanic baggage.
That must have felt good.
DiCaprio described it as the most adventurous, supercharged movie making he had experienced, shot across an astounding 147 locations in just 52 days.
Whoa, whirlwind production.
Roger Ebert praised his departure from darker characters, and Entertainment Weekly called it his best role, labeling him delightfully persuasive, deceptive, flirtatious, and sometimes tragic.
I praise.
Earned him his third Golden Globe nomination for this role, really demonstrating his versatility.
And then came the first of his truly legendary collaborations, right? A partnership that would reshape both their careers.
You mean Scorsese?
Exactly. Also in 2002, he starred in Martin Scorsese's sprawling epic, Gangs of New York.
Huge film. Passion project for Scorsese.
Scorsese initially struggled immensely to secure financing for it until DiCaprio showed interest, which then led Miramax Films to get involved.
So Leo's star power was already opening doors for major directors.
Clearly. Helping get complex, ambitious films off the ground, DiCaprio was deeply drawn to playing Amsterdam Valen, the Irish-American street gang leader, saw it as a deliberate shift from boyish roles to a mature leading man.
A conscious step up.
While some critics felt Daniel Day-Lewis's Oscar-winning performance often overshadowed him.
Which, I mean, Day-Lewis tends to do.
Fair point. It was undeniably a pivotal step towards a more mature, grittier image and a more substantial body of work for DiCaprio.
And that influence extended beyond just acting. He was increasingly seeking control behind the scenes, too.
With his production company.
Exactly. In 2004, DiCaprio founded Appian Way Productions, named after an ancient Italian road.
Why start a company, then?
His motivation was a clear desire for greater creative autonomy and integrity. He wanted to find unique source material and preserve its essence during development, citing negative experiences where too many people influenced the final product and diluted the original vision.
Taking control back.
Precisely.
Yeah.
A direct response to the Hollywood machine. His first executive production under Appian Way was The Assassination of Richard Nixon in 2004, already indicating his interest in historical dramas and complex characters.
That's a strong statement about artistic integrity, really putting his money and influence where his creative vision is, and it allowed him to shape the kind of stories he wanted to tell.
And this dedication to his craft truly deepened during what many now call the Scorsese era, a partnership that would yield some of his most iconic performances.
Starting with?
They reunited for The Aviator in 2004. Biopic about the eccentric billionaire Howard Hughes, which DiCaprio also co-produced under Appian Way.
Big role, big production.
Huge. And it was a critical and financial success, grossing $213 million worldwide. Simon Braun of Empire Magazine praised his convincing portrayal of such a complex, unraveling character, especially Hughes's descent into paranoia and obsession.
Yeah.
Really captured the genius and the madness.
And the awards finally came for a lead role, right?
Right. This earned him his first Golden Globe Award for Best Actor Motion Picture Drama, along with nominations for an Academy Award, a BAFTA, and a Screen Actors Guild Award. The recognition was finally pouring in for his lead dramatic work.
About time.
Their collaboration only intensified after that, became one of cinema's most celebrated actor-director duos. In 2006, DiCaprio starred in Scorsese's gritty crime thriller, The Departed.
Incredible film.
Playing Billy Costigan, a state trooper deep undercover in the Irish mob. He described his character as being in a constant 24-hour panic attack.
You could feel that tension.
Absolutely. He found working with Jack Nicholson one of the most memorable moments of his acting life. A true masterclass, you imagine.
Boy, for sure.
For preparation, he immersed himself, visited Boston, gained 15 pounds of muscle to embody the physicality of the role.
Committed.
It became his and Scorsese's highest grossing collaboration at the time, earning $291 million. Peter Travers lauded his and Matt Damon's explosive, emotionally complex performances, highlighted the film's raw power.
Yeah, they were amazing together.
Interestingly, Warner Bros. Made a strategic decision to submit his performance for a Best Supporting Actor Oscar.
Supporting? Why?
To avoid internal conflict with his leading role in Blood Diamond that same year, though Mark Wahlberg ultimately received the nomination for The Departed.
Ah, award strategy. Yeah. That illuminates the strategic, almost chess-like nature of awards campaigns in Hollywood, even for a talent like DiCaprio.
It really does. Fascinating behind-the-scenes stuff.
And speaking of Blood Diamond in 2006, here he starred as Danny Archer, a diamond smuggler embroiled in the Sierra Leone Civil War. This role clearly had a profound impact on him personally and professionally. During filming, he worked with 24 orphan children from the SOS Children's Village in Maputo, Mozambique. Said he was deeply moved by the experience, which undeniably fueled his later humanitarian efforts.
Wow, that's powerful.
He spent 6 months in Africa preparing for the role, learned camouflage, perfected a difficult Rhodesian South African accent, which received significant praise for its authenticity.
6 months prep. Serious dedication.
Critics noted his growth and transition from a boy to a man on screen, recognized his increasingly mature presence, earned him both Oscar and Golden Globe nominations. This really underscored his commitment to using his platform and his art to shed light on global issues and the human cost of conflict.
He continued to balance acting with his growing producing and advocacy roles then, right?
Yeah, sure.
A clear pattern of multi-hyphenate involvement.
Definitely. In 2007, he produced the comedy drama Gardener of Eden, which apparently lacked the necessary dramatic urgency, according to The Hollywood Reporter, shows not every producing venture hits the mark.
True. Can't win them all.
But later that year, he produced, co-wrote, and narrated The 11th Hour, a powerful documentary on the state of the natural environment, which won an Earthwatch Environmental Film Award.
Ah, leaning into the environmental work.
Yeah, and his production company, Appian Way, also produced Greensburg from 2008 to 2010, a documentary series about rebuilding a Kansas town sustainably after a devastating tornado.
Interesting project.
In 2008, he starred in the spy film Body of Lies, undertook physical transformations like dyeing his hair brown, wearing brown contacts for the role, another example of his commitment to character detail.
Always tweaking the look.
Then, in a truly poignant and highly anticipated reunion, he collaborated with Kate Winslet again for Revolutionary Road in 2008.
Back together again, but a very different film.
Totally different. Directed by her then-husband, Sam Mendes, Winslet actually suggested the project, as both actors were reluctant to make another romantic film like Titanic, wisely choosing to defy audience expectations.
Smart move. Explore different territory.
Here, they played a couple in a failing 1950s marriage. Stark, often painful contrast to their blockbuster romance. DiCaprio described his character Frank Wheeler as unheroic and slightly powerly, allowed him to explore a very different, more vulnerable, flawed facet of masculinity.
Showing real range.
Peter Travers called it a multi-layered portrayal, and Marshall Sella labeled it his most mature and memorable performance up to that point. Earned him his 7th Golden Globe nomination, proved their chemistry endured and could explore much deeper, more complex emotional terrain, far beyond the Titanic.
Great pairing, different context. He also produced the psychological horror film Orphan in 2009, right?
Yep, keeping Appian Way busy.
The early 2010s saw him continue with both blockbusters and deep, often psychologically intense character work. He collaborated with Scorsese again on the 2010 psychological thriller Shutter Island.
Oh, that was a trip.
Playing U.S. Marshal Edward Daniels, investigating a psychiatric facility and increasingly questioning his own sanity. The disturbing nature of the scenes actually gave him nightmares during production.
Wow, really got under skin.
Highlights the intensity of his immersion in the role. Peter Travers praised it as his most haunting and emotionally complex performance yet, capturing the descent into madness with unsettling precision. It was a commercial success, too, grossing $294 million.
Yeah, kid.
Also in 2010, he starred in Christopher Nolan's critically acclaimed sci-fi film, Inception.
Mind-bending.
Playing Dom Cobb, an extractor, manipulating dreams. DiCaprio was fascinated by the dream heist concept and its profound implications for reality. It became his second highest grossing film, taking in $836 million worldwide.
Huge numbers again.
And in a bold and savvy move, he took a pay cut from his usual $20 million fee for a share in first dollar gross points, a gamble that paid off handsomely, ultimately earning him $50 million, his highest payday yet.
Smart. Betting on Nolan and the concept.
Truly highlights his keen business acumen when he genuinely believed in a project's potential and its visionary director.
That's a truly smart bet. He clearly understands the business as well as the art, a rare combination. In 2011, he starred as J. Edgar Hoover in Clint Eastwood's J. Edgar.
Another biopic, complex figure.
Yeah, examining Hoover's public career and alleged private life. While the film received mixed reviews for its coherence and narrative structure, DiCaprio's performance was widely commended.
His part was praised, even if the film wasn't universally loved.
Right. Roger Ebert noted his uncanny ability to bring depth and nuance to such a secretive figure, perhaps revealing aspects of Hoover's personality unknown even to himself. a testament to his interpretive skills.
He also continued his producing work around that, right?
Yep. Supported Catherine Hardwicke's Red Riding Hood and George Clooney's political drama The Ides of March that year, keeping busy behind the camera, too.
And then, in 2012, came Quentin Tarantino's spaghetti western, Django Unchained.
Ooh, Calvin Candy. Chilling performance.
Playing the villainous plantation owner. A truly unsettling character. He initially felt uncomfortable with the film's intense and unflinching portrayal of racism, which speaks to his moral compass.
Understandable.
But he was convinced by his co-stars and Tarantino not to sugarcoat it. Understood the artistic necessity of historical accuracy and impact.
Right. And wasn't there that famous scene where he cut his hand?
Exactly. During a particularly intense scene, he accidentally cut his hand badly on glass. But in a remarkable display of dedication, he continued the scene without breaking character. Smeared blood on Kerry Washington's face.
Oh, intense.
Tarantino, witnessing this raw authenticity, decided to use that take in the final product. Critics found his performance blood-chilling and utterly captivating, earned him a Golden Globe nomination for Best Supporting Actor.
Deservedly so.
The film grossed $425 million worldwide, further cementing his ability to deliver powerful performances even in morally ambiguous roles. This incident clearly illustrates his unwavering commitment to realism and character, even in the most extreme circumstances.
Wow, that's dedication to craft, bleeding for your art, quite literally. His career trajectory then took an even more deliberate turn, intertwining his professional life with his deeply personal convictions.
Oh, so.
In January 2013, DiCaprio announced a significant break from acting, said he wanted to fly around the world doing good for the environment.
A sabbatical for the planet.
Pretty much. Marks a clear pivot, or at least an intensely intensified focus, in his public life. Consciously intertwined his celebrity with his deep-seated passion for ecological causes, signaling a shift in priorities.
That's a pretty strong declaration, and it showed how seriously he took his environmental advocacy. Yet even during this pivotal phase, he had several significant artistic pursuits already in the pipeline, right?
Yeah, the wheels were still turning. The Great Gatsby in 2013, another visually stunning collaboration with Baz Luhrmann.
Crack with Baz.
Saw him star as the enigmatic Jay Gatsby. While the film had mixed reviews, often criticized for style over substance.
Yeah, some found it a bit much.
DiCaprio's performance was widely praised as its anchor. Rafer Guzman called it a tremendous, hard-won performance, noting the effort he put into capturing the character's elusive charm and underlying tragedy. Matt Zollerseitz deemed it iconic, maybe his career best.
High praise indeed.
He won the AACTA Award for Best Actor, and the film was a commercial success, grossing $353 million. Demonstrated his ability to elevate a project even when it's critically divisive.
And then his sixth collaboration with Scorsese, right? The Wolf of Wall Street.
Oh, boy. 2013, a frenetic and often outrageous portrayal of excess.
He'd wanted to make that for a while, hadn't he?
Yeah, DiCaprio had actually wanted to play the infamous stockbroker Jordan Belfort ever since reading his autobiography, won a fierce bidding war for the rights back in 2007, showcasing his proactive approach to securing passion projects.
So he really pursued that one.
He was drawn to Belfort's honest and unapologetic portrayal of his experiences and was notably inspired by the 2008 financial crisis to make the film. Saw it as a cautionary tale.
Timely, given the financial crash.
Critics lauded his carefree performance and great deal of comedic talent, which was a delightful departure for him. Earned him a Golden Globe for Best Actor, Motion Picture, Musical, or Comedy, plus Oscar and BAFTA nominations for Best Actor and Best Picture.
Huge success, critically and commercially.
Beyond acting, he continued his robust producing work. Executive produced Virunga in 2014, that British documentary about protecting mountain gorillas, earned him a Primetime Emmy nomination.
Important film.
He also executive produced and participated in a new cut of Cowspiracy, The Sustainability Secret, exploring animal agriculture's often overlooked environmental impact, further cementing his role as a prominent environmental producer and advocate.
And then came the role that finally truly secured his long-awaited Academy Award. A moment that felt almost preordained after years of acclaimed performances.
Revenant.
2015. He produced and starred as the legendary fur trapper Hugh Glass in Alejandro G. Iñárritu's brutal survival drama.
That shoot sounded absolutely brutal.
Notoriously difficult. Demanded an almost unimaginable level of physical and mental endurance. He had to eat a raw bison liver. sleep in animal carcasses, learn to shoot a musket, build a fire, even speak two Native American languages, Pawnee and Arikara, and apply ancient healing techniques.
Wow, the lengths he goes to.
It raises an important question for us, doesn't it? Not just about his commitment, but what this level of immersion and physical sacrifice tells you about his drive for authenticity. And maybe what he felt he needed to prove at that point in his career after so many near misses with the Oscar.
It was an all-in performance, no question.
It speaks volumes to his dedication, a true tour de force. The film received overwhelmingly positive reviews, with particular praise for his physically demanding and transformative performance that transcended mere acting.
People were blown away.
Mark Kermode noted how his performance prioritized physicality over speech, conveying immense emotion and suffering through pure action. Nick Desemlian said he uplifted the film with his sheer presence and grit.
And the awards finally came.
Indeed. He swept the award season. Won the Academy Award, BAFTA, Critics' Choice, Golden Globe, and SAG Award for Best Actor.
Oh.
Finally clinching that elusive Oscar.
Must have been a huge moment.
His acceptance speech was powerful, unforgettable. He used the global platform not to celebrate himself, but to immediately declare, climate change is real, it is happening right now, it is the most urgent threat facing our entire species, and we need to work collectively together and stop procrastinating.
Wow. Using his moment for the cause, that was a significant moment for his advocacy, seamlessly leveraging his personal triumph for something bigger.
And he certainly put his actions where his words were after that. For the next 3 years after his Oscar win, he largely focused on narrating and producing documentaries, signaled a clear shift in his direct artistic output and a deepened commitment to his environmental mission.
What kind of documentaries?
Included The Ivory Game and Catching the Sun, both in 2016, shedding light on critical ecological issues. He also produced, hosted, and narrated Before the Flood in 2016, a powerful and widely watched documentary on climate change, interviewing global leaders and experts.
So really doubling down on the advocacy.
Yeah. While he produced the crime drama Live by Night in 2016, which failed commercially, and the action adventure Robin Hood in 2018, his heart seemed to be increasingly environmental storytelling. In 2019, he produced and narrated yet another global warming documentary, Ice on Fire, underscoring this consistent focus.
Following that period of intense environmental focus and producing, DiCaprio made a triumphant return to acting after a 4-year break. Felt like a truly grand comeback.
Which film was this?
2019. Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Oh, with Brad Pitt. Great pairing.
Playing Rick Dalton, an aging television actor struggling to adapt, alongside Pitt as his stunt double and best friend. To help finance the film, both he and Pitt agreed to take significant pay cuts. Demonstrated their commitment to Tarantino's vision.
Shows they really wanted to make it happen.
They loved working with Pitt. And Tarantino himself called their dynamic the most exciting since Robert Redford and Paul Newman.
High praise indeed.
DiCaprio drew from real-life experiences, witnessing the struggles and rejections of his actor friends in the industry, lent a profound, empathetic authenticity to his character. Critics universally praised his performance and the duo's undeniable chemistry, earned him Oscar, Golden Globe, BAFTA, and SAG Award nominations.
Quite the comeback. Showcased his ability to return to the screen with renewed vigor. He also executive produced The Right Stuff in 2020, that TV series about the early space program.
Right, and made a brief appearance in the Last Dance finale that same year, popped up in an unexpected context.
Then, in 2021, he co-starred with Jennifer Lawrence in Adam McKay's satirical comedy Don't Look Up.
The Comet movie, that got people talking.
He actually spent 5 months changing the script with McKay before agreeing to the part. Viewed the film as a crucial analogy for the world's indifference to the climate crisis.
5 months on the script. Wow. Real involvement.
Demonstrates his commitment not just to acting, but to shaping the message of the films he's in. He praised McKay for envisioning a project that explored how humans would react to such a serious existential issue, politically, socially, scientifically.
Despite mixed film reviews, his and Lawrence's performances were widely praised.
Absolutely. And the film broke Netflix viewing records. Over 150 million hours viewed in a single week. Huge impact.
His most recent significant acting role was in 2023 in Killers of the Flower Moon, another monumental collaboration with Martin Scorsese.
Back with Morty again.
For which he was paid a substantial $30 million. Interestingly, and this is a truly revealing detail about his artistic control and vision, he was originally set to play the heroic FBI agent in the film.
Oh, really? Tom White.
Yep. But he insisted on playing the morally complex murderer Ernest Burkhart instead, argued it was a more challenging and compelling character to inhabit.
Wow, that's a bold choice. Changed the whole focus of the film.
Exactly. This decision led to extensive script rewrites, a testament to his influence and his drive to inhabit demanding multifaceted characters over more straightforward heroic ones. Critics called it, unequivocally, the best performance of DiCaprio's career.
High praise indeed.
IndieWire praised his nuanced and uncompromising turn. He received yet another Golden Globe nomination for his powerful portrayal.
So what's next for him?
Looking ahead, he's set to star in Paul Thomas Anderson's upcoming film, One Battle After Another, with Sean Penn and Regina Hall, promising another exciting chapter.
PTA, Sean Penn, Regina Hall. That sounds intense.
Definitely one to watch.
It's clear that his career choices are anything but conventional, and his impact on cinema is undeniable. DiCaprio is consistently regarded as one of the finest actors of his generation.
Absolutely.
In a 2022 readers poll by Empire, he was voted one of the 50 greatest actors of all time. Praised for his willingness to go to the ends of the earth, often literally, to get under his character's skin, a clear reference to the Revenant.
He really committed.
Colin Covert of the Seattle Times believes DiCaprio has redefined film stardom by consistently taking on challenging, complex roles that few contemporaries are capable of performing. And he's almost alone in his ability to command box office success through pure star power rather than relying on existing franchises.
That's a great point. He is the brand.
He views film as a relevant art form, like a painting or sculpture, enduring for 100 years, which speaks to his long-term vision for his work and his legacy.
Takes it seriously.
He frequently portrays real-life people and characters in historical periods, often excelling at playing frauds and cheats and double-crossing liars and mercenaries, as Derek Thompson of The Atlantic noted, and characters who gradually lose mental stability. Demonstrates a fascination with the darker, more fractured aspects of the human psyche.
It's fascinating how those kinds of morally ambiguous characters, often teetering on the edge, consistently resonate with him and bring out his best work.
Indeed. His successful collaborations with Scorsese are often considered career-defining moments for both, akin to Scorsese's iconic work with Robert De Niro.
Legendary partnership.
DiCaprio credits Scorsese with teaching him film history and its profound importance, grounding him in the cinematic lineage. While Scorsese praises DiCaprio's ability to repeatedly demonstrate raw, authentic emotion on screen, scene after scene.
High praise from the master.
Agnieszka Holland, who directed him way back in Total Eclipse, described him as one of the most mature actors she's worked with. Highlighted his courageous choices and ability to become the character without solely relying on method acting. Indicates an intuitive connection to his roles.
Meryl Streep also noted his unpredictability, right? A quality that keeps audiences and fellow actors on their toes.
Yeah. And film critic Philip French has even suggested that DiCaprio's inclination toward films about dysfunctional families and characters seeking father figures might subtly allude to his own troubled childhood and that unique family structure he experienced offers an interesting psychological lens.
That's a truly perceptive observation, linking his personal background to his artistic preferences. And here's a rare feat in Hollywood, especially today. He's built this incredibly successful career without ever starring in a comic book movie, a family film, or a pre-branded franchise.
It's remarkable in this era.
The Hollywood Reporter unequivocally declared, "Leo is the franchise." Which truly makes us ponder, what does this tell you about the enduring power of character-driven performances and the individual star in an era dominated by intellectual property and massive cinematic universes?
It's proof that star power and artistic integrity can still win out, a unique path he's carved.
His personal philosophy remains remarkably grounded, too. He said, "My attitude is the same as when I started. I feel very connected to that 15-year-old kid who got his first movie."
Stays connected to his roots.
And his inspirations. He names Robert De Niro, the man who first picked him, and James Dean, particularly Dean's raw and powerful performance in East of Eden, as profoundly influential in shaping his own approach to acting.
Makes sense. You see shades of both sometimes. Beyond acting, DiCaprio is, without a doubt, one of the most highly active and vocal celebrities in the climate change movement, consistently calling global warming the world's number one environmental challenge.
He's been passionate about it for a long time.
Yeah, his passion for ecology began early. Watching documentaries on rainforest depletion and species loss instilled in him a deep sense of urgency. In 1998, he established the Leonardo DiCaprio Foundation.
The LDF, right.
By 2018, it had supported over 200 projects with more than $100 million, all aimed at promoting environmental awareness and ensuring a viable future for Earth. He's served on the boards of prestigious organizations like the World Wildlife Fund and the International Fund for Animal Welfare, demonstrating a hands-on commitment beyond just lending his name.
His environmental actions are extensive and varied, demonstrates a comprehensive approach to advocacy. For instance, he's owned electric hybrid vehicles, showcasing personal commitment to sustainable living.
Though he does get criticized for the private jets sometimes.
Right. It's worth noting, as some critics have pointed out, he has faced criticism for the perceived hypocrisy of his occasional use of private jets and large yachts, which undeniably have significant carbon footprints.
It's that complex tightrope walk public figures face.
Exactly. Where personal lifestyle choices are scrutinized against public advocacy, a tension almost inherent to global celebrity. But back in 2000, he chaired the National Earth Day celebration, famously interviewing President Bill Clinton about global warming, using his platform to engage political leaders directly.
He presented at Live Earth in 2007 and notably donated $1 million to the Wildlife Conservation Society at Russia's Tiger Summit, where his persistence in reaching the event after two plane delays led Vladimir Putin to call him a muzhik, or real man.
Huh, a muzhik from Putin. Unexpected.
Right. In 2013, he organized the 11th Hour Fine Art Auction, raising nearly $38.8 million for his foundation, showing creative ways to fund his initiatives.
His influence reached an even more significant global stage in September 2014, didn't it, with the UN?
Yeah. When United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon officially designated DiCaprio as a United Nations Messenger of Peace with a specific focus on climate change.
Huge platform.
His opening statement at the UN Climate Summit that same month reached an estimated 1 billion people worldwide, a truly staggering reach for one person's message.
Incredible.
In 2015, he announced his intention to divest from fossil fuels, a significant personal and financial commitment underscoring his belief in sustainable investments. He spoke at the UN again in April 2016, prior to the signing of the landmark Paris Climate Change Agreement, urging world leaders to act decisively.
He even met the Pope, right?
Yep, met Pope Francis that year to discuss environmental issues, donating to charity through the Vatican.
He also traveled to Indonesia in 2016 to publicly criticize the palm oil industry's destructive slash-and-burn forest clearing methods, drew significant international attention to a crucial environmental issue.
Using his spotlight effectively.
In July 2016, his foundation committed an impressive $15.6 million to protect wildlife and Native American rights and mitigate climate change, showcasing a broad scope of environmental justice.
Connecting environmental and social issues.
That October, he joined Mark Ruffalo in supporting the Standing Rock Tribe's opposition to the Dakota Access Pipeline, lending his celebrity to indigenous rights and environmental protection.
Taking a stand.
In April 2017, he visibly protested against President Donald Trump's perceived inaction on climate change by attending the People's Climate March in Washington, D.C.
Putting himself out there physically.
Later that year, his foundation raised over $30 million in one night at a charity auction and concert. And in December 2018, it further committed a $100 million to fight climate change. Most recently, in May 2021, he pledged $43 million for Galapagos Islands conservation, continuing to allocate significant resources to biodiversity protection.
Beyond the environment, his philanthropy is impressively broad and consistently impactful, too.
Yeah. Like, what else?
In 1998, he and his mother donated $35,000 for a Leonardo DiCaprio computer center at a Los Feliz library, supporting local community development. In a truly touching gesture in 2009, he and Kate Winslet donated $20,000 to support Titanic survivor Melvina Dean's nursing home fees.
Oh, that's lovely. Demonstrates enduring care.
He donated $1 million for Haiti earthquake relief in 2010. Responding to a global crisis.
Yeah.
Supported the Animal Legal Defense Fund's campaign to release Coney, a tiger at a truck stop, in 2011, showing his concern for animal welfare.
He wears a lot of ground.
Donated $61,000 to the gay rights group GLA in 2013 and $65,000 to the Children of Armenia Fund in 2016. Provided $1 million for Hurricane Harvey relief in 2017 and $3 million for Australia bushfire relief efforts in 2020.
Consistently steps up. What about Ukraine?
While initial media reports announced a $10 million donation to Ukraine amidst the 2022 invasion, the exact amount was later suggested to be inaccurate by the Associated Press, though he certainly contributed significantly to humanitarian groups working in the region.
His political engagements are also quite public. Reflect a consistent alignment with his environmental stance.
Seems focused there.
Endorsed Hillary Clinton for the 2016 presidential election, attended a fundraiser for Joe Biden in 2020, clearly supporting Democratic candidates. In 2020, he narrated a Netflix documentary series on voting rights, urging voter participation and drawing crucial attention to issues like voter suppression and restrictive ID laws. Directed people to sources like VoteWriters for assistance.
Using his voice for democracy, too.
In 2023, he notably testified during the trial against Prakash Rao Mishal, who was accused of a foreign influence campaign, linked him to a high-profile legal case.
Wow, testified in court.
Most recently, in October 2024, he formally endorsed Democratic nominee Kamala Harris for president, cited her climate change mitigation policies, and openly criticized Donald Trump, showing a clear and unwavering political alignment on environmental issues that seems to transcend party lines for him.
Despite his very public advocacy and political leanings, DiCaprio himself is agnostic, and his personal life is frequently under intense media scrutiny, though he rarely grants interviews about it. Chooses to keep that aspect highly private.
Understandable, given the focus.
Early in his career, particularly in the 1990s, he gained a certain reputation for reckless behavior and intense partying with a group dubbed the Pussy Posse.
Ah, yes, that infamous name.
Journalist Nancy Jo Sales criticized them for chasing girls, picking fights, and not tipping the waitress. Painted a picture of a youthful, wild period. He even had a near-fatal parachute failure experience.
Sweet, sweet.
Responding with characteristic bravado that he's fond of doing things that scare him, which perhaps connects to his risk-taking and roles in life.
Huh. During this period, Senator John McCain famously, and rather harshly, called him an androgynous wimp in a public jab.
Ouch. Politics getting personal.
DiCaprio, for his part, felt people's perception of him was exaggerated, stating, "They want you miserable, just like them. They don't want heroes. What they want is to see you fall." A rather cynical but perhaps accurate view of celebrity culture.
Yeah, the pressure must be immense. Steven Spielberg, however, defended him as family-oriented during the filming of Catch Me If You Can, offering a contrasting view.
Interesting counterpoint.
Karen James credited him as one of the few actors to genuinely use his stardom for social causes, while Carol Cadwalader noted his polite, charming demeanor in interviews, but that he gives almost no hint whatsoever of his actual personality, suggesting a carefully constructed public persona.
That distinction between his carefully managed public self and his intensely private life is really striking, a common thread for many global figures. DiCaprio's relationships, for example, have frequently been a topic of intense public discussion, particularly since he entered his 40s.
Ah, the dating life scrutiny.
Yeah, there's been significant criticism directed at the age disparity with his partners, who are often 25 or younger. This has even been widely referenced in pop culture Taylor Swift's song, jokes at the Golden Globes and Academy Awards, makes it a well-known aspect of his public persona.
Hard to avoid hearing about it.
His ex-girlfriend Camila Maroney, however, defended the age gap, stating anyone should be able to date who they want, offering a different perspective.
Fair point from her.
He has dated several notable models, including Gisele Bündchen, Bara Raffaelli, and Tony Garn. Most recently, Vittoria Ceretti since August 2023. He even successfully sued a French tabloid for falsely claiming he had gotten Rihanna pregnant. Demonstrates he's willing to push back aggressively against invasive speculation and false reporting.
Draws a line when needed. His personal life also involves significant real estate holdings, right? Often subjects of public interest.
Yeah. Owns multiple properties, houses in LA, apartments in NYC. And he even purchased an entire island off Belize, Blackador Cay.
An island? Wow. What's the plan there?
Plans to open an environmentally friendly resort. Another example of his environmental commitment bleeding into his personal investments, aiming for sustainable tourism.
Interesting venture. And wasn't there a serious incident at a party once?
Oh, yeah. Really shocking. In 2005, he was severely injured at a Hollywood party when model Aretha Wilson hit him with a broken bottle, required 17 stitches to his face and neck.
Good grief. That's terrible.
Wilson was later sentenced to 2 years in prison for the assault.
And more recently, he's faced several controversies that truly highlight the intense scrutiny public figures endure, where their choices are constantly weighed against their public image.
Like what?
In 2017, for instance, he turned over gifts he received from associates involved in the One Malaysia Development Berhad scandal, that massive global financial scandal.
Oh, right, the 1MDB thing. What kind of gifts?
Valuable items like Marlon Brando's Oscar, a Picasso painting, a Basquiat collage. He returned them to the U.S. government, linked him indirectly to a major financial crime, though he wasn't accused of wrongdoing himself.
Still, not a great association.
Then, in June 2025, he drew criticism for attending Jeff Bezos's and Lauren Sanchez's wedding. given Amazon's significant environmental impact and his vocal climate advocacy.
Ah, the hypocrisy debate again.
Exactly. He was even photographed trying to hide his face from paparazzi, which really brought that debate to the forefront again.
Yeah.
Sparked renewed public discussion about the choices of climate advocates.
Tricky situation.
And in July 2025, he received backlash from activists for co-financing a luxury hotel project near Tel Aviv, Israel, despite the ongoing Gaza-Israel conflict, on which he has remained notably silent.
Oh, that's sensitive territory.
These events really illustrate the incredibly challenging tightrope walk public figures often face, where their personal actions and financial decisions are intensely scrutinized against their public advocacy and reputation, creates complex tensions that are difficult to navigate under the relentless spotlight.
What an extraordinary journey we've taken, really. We've seen Leonardo DiCaprio evolve from a child actor navigating early struggles and that challenging bohemian upbringing through the unprecedented Leomania of Titanic to his deliberate and often defiant crafting of a career defined by challenging character-driven roles with visionary directors like Martin Scorsese and Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah, that artistic integrity really shines through. We've also delved into his profound and unwavering commitment to environmentalism, his significant philanthropic efforts across various causes,
right,
and the constant public scrutiny he navigates, both for his professional choices and the more complex aspects of his personal life, highlighting that inherent tension in global fame.
So for you, the curious learner, this deep dive should offer a complete sort of 360-degree view, allowing you to appreciate the deliberate choices, the unwavering artistic integrity, and the enduring impact of a truly multifaceted global icon.
Yeah, hopefully you now have a comprehensive understanding that goes far beyond the headlines and the simple narratives, understanding the complex driven individual behind the famous name and the nuanced decisions that have shaped his extraordinary path.
As we reflect on Leonardo DiCaprio's decades-long career, from wanting to shed that romantic hero image to consistently using his immense platform for urgent climate action and the controversies he's navigated, consider this.
What does it truly mean to leverage global fame for a cause greater than oneself? And how do we, as an audience, reconcile the complexities of a public figure's personal choices, whether they're lifestyle choices, relationships, or investments, with their powerful and, frankly, necessary public messages?
That's a tough one. What kind of transformation can a single individual inspire in the world? And what are the inherent tensions, the trade-offs, and the public expectations that come with that process, especially when every single action is under the microscope?
It leaves us with a lot to ponder, doesn't it? About the nature of celebrity, advocacy, and personal integrity in the 21st century.